Tony Leon was one of the most successful politicians in South Africa, leader of the opposition in South Africa's parliament from 1999 to 2007. But before that, played a huge role in, well, what could be a transitional move next year with the big watershed election coming post-2024. This is something that Tony's been working on for 40 years, I'm sure. He'll be telling us more about it in a moment. Tony Leon, appointed as South Africa's ambassador by Jacob Zuma, and then you left the stage in 2012 as a young man, 55. I mean, for both of us now, that seems like a very young age. Are you a bit remorseful or unhappy that you left the stage then, given where we are now in a very exciting time in South African politics?
Well, just to talk about ageism for a moment, I was much fortified last night by going to the Grand West Arena in Cape Town to see Sting, who performed this magic concert age 71. So I thought, well, I've got about 5 years to go, so that's still some fuel in the tank, Alec. Look, I did what I did, to misquote Franklin Roosevelt, with what I had from where I was. And I was leader of my party for 13 years, which is probably far too long, but I was very involved in the reconstruction or the construction of opposition in South Africa by merging together the Democratic Party and the former sworn enemies, the National Party, and creating the Democratic Alliance, which creation actually is the essential reason why the DA governs the Western Cape, city of Cape Town, and a belt of other municipalities. And the idea was to really close down the opposition fight and take the fight to the majority party, the ANC. And when that had been accomplished by 2007, I thought the baton must be passed on to someone else. And indeed, Ellen Ziller picked it up and did pretty well with it. And you know, I think you've got to know, you know, as Mornay Duplessis said to me when I quit, he said to me, this is a bit like when I stood down as Springbok rugby captain. He said, it's much better for people to ask why you aren't on the field than why you're still on it. So I thought that was very wise career and transitional advice, and I've tried to apply it. And so, you know, I don't have regrets. There are other folk who are doing what I used to do, and they're doing it in very different circumstances than I had to contend with, and I wish them well.
I'm going to return to that a little later, but it reminds me of a discussion I had with James Lorimer, who's in the DA, ex-journalist, ex-communications
field. My former
field.
Press secretary when I was the leader, incidentally.
Indeed, and James says, it's just so exciting when you are covering this as a journalist. It's almost like he called it the gateway drug, journalism or communications into politics. But you've certainly kicked the habit by going from politics into the private sector, into more of a reputational management communications role. Seems the wrong way around, Tony, especially now that things are getting very exciting in your old stamping ground.
Well, you know, I needed to keep my brain active and put some groceries on the table. So we formed Resolve Communications 10 years ago. Now it's been a pretty successful company. And, you know, we apply a lot of the political management lessons to private sector, not in terms of making it politicized, but a lot of the campaigns, a lot of the issues need to be given a set of disciplines, which perhaps you get from both being, in my case, a detribalized lawyer and a detribalized politician. We've got a great team who work around a number of sectors, and they've done pretty well. But I keep my oar on the water in the sense I do write, sadly not for business news, I need to say, but which I also read, but I write for you know, newspapers in South Africa, and I do quite a lot of speeches around and about here and outside South Africa. So I remain an engaged participant, but not, you know, in the front line of party politics, which has both potential but also limitations, Alec. You know, I don't have to wake up every morning thinking, what is the party like? I need to wake up think, what do I think about this? And there's actually a big difference between that because, you know, I'm not recruiting votes or harvesting support. I just put my views out there. I hope they're based on something sounder than just prejudice or hunch or impulse. And I found that very, you know, absorbing.
And people do find it a massive contribution to the discourse in South Africa. And I'm not surprised that your Resolve Communications has been that successful, because we, in a developing country, we have politics, which is more important than economics. If you don't get the politics right, well, then, you know, the businesses are certainly not going to succeed. But getting back to your own background, your dad was a high court judge. Your parents, both of them, were very involved in the Progressive Party. And then you, as an 18-year-old, looking at your Wikipedia page, because Wikipedia knows all, started getting involved as in the Progressive Party. So it was almost like preordained. On the one hand, becoming a lawyer, like your brother Peter, and we can touch on him in a moment. On the other hand, going into the Progressive Party of your parents.
Absolutely. The Progressive Party in Durban was more or less formed in our lounge when I was about 4 years old, and all the party grandees used to stay overnight in our Durban home. So I was kind of immersed in it from an early age. And, you know, my first job before I had to go to the army was as an organizer, paid 100 rand a month. Seemed a lot of money in the 1975. So I was pretty involved. But then, of course, I went on and I went to university and I qualified as an attorney. And I said a big commercial law practice, didn't leave too much time for political activity. And then it just happened one day that I got a phone call to say there was a by-election coming up in the Joburg City Council. Now, I hadn't been actively involved in politics for the preceding year or so. And I stood as a candidate and I won my first election in Bellevue, Johannesburg by 39 votes. And that set in train my political career. But I guess a lot of my background was leading up to that moment.
So help me understand where the two young lions of the Democratic Alliance, Chris Pappas, who was in The Economist last week. Quite an achievement. And Jordan Hill Lewis, who's probably going to be in The Economist next week, what he's doing in Cape Town. What can we expect from them going into the future, given that you were a very precocious and successful politician at an early age, as they are?
Well, I was elected to Parliament when I was 32 as the MP for Houghton. Jordan, whom I know extremely well. Jordan, and I don't want to, you know, make him into my prototype. He certainly isn't that. He's got exceptional qualities, as I think all the residents of Cape Town now see and the wider public. I met Jordan when he was an 18-year-old activist in the party at a by-election when I was the leader. And I said to our campaign organizer, I said, who's that chap? He was, you know, ordering around old ladies to do things and so on. He said, oh, his name's Jordan Hill Lewis. And I said, you know, he reminds me of me at the age of 18 because he just had extraordinary political acumen. So I don't want to say I had it, but he just showed a depth of knowledge that was unusual. And, you know, in any society, in any polity, someone like Jordan would be exceptional. In South Africa, we have an enormous dumbing down and mediocritization, if that's the right word, Alec. And Jordan, you know, rises above that because of his own merits. And I think folk are seeing that now, you know, on the bigger stage that he's on. Chris Pappas, I met once at a dinner in Durban. So I don't know him as well, but he certainly seems to also have, you know, great talent. And what they both, I said to Jordan, you know, when we spoke before he became mayor, I said, you just have to get up in the morning, don't steal the money and, you know, do your basic task. You'll do me better than most other mayors in South Africa, which is perfectly true. Well, he's, of course, done much more than that. And he will continue to do more than that. But both Jordan and Chris Pappas are exceptional people. But they also, you know, they do the basics. They're not pretentious. They don't sort of, you know, have these sort of delusions of grandeur and sort of some sense of that they've got some God-given right to, you know, be mayor or whatever it is. That's not their shtick at all. And they pay attention to detail. I also think with them, and it's not confined to them, but it's perhaps unusual, they have a good judgment. You know, it's one thing to have, we had Thabo Mbeki was very intelligent and very intellectually studied, but he had shocking judgment, as we saw over the HIV/AIDS debacle, which cost hundreds of thousands of lives. I think to have good judgment allied to integrity and intelligence is the important combination in a political or any other career, I guess, Alec.
We've got to dwell a little on the other young lion of the DA who's gone off to Action SA, Bongani Baloyi, and the inability, it seems, of the party to retain the black talent somehow. Now, that's a perception from the outside. You know the party well, it was your party, and you always call a spade a bloody shovel. So help us out here. How did they lose someone as talented as that?
Yeah, I didn't know Bongani, but I accept he was a very competent mayor of Midvale, and, you know, seemed to tick all the boxes and probably a few more that weren't on the page during his tenure as mayor. I don't personally know, because I don't know him and I don't interrogate the party's comings and goings, why he left or why he joined Action SA, but I accept that there's a perception issue here rather than a reality issue, because every time a few folk leave, the DA will publish a list of, but hang on, we've got dozens and dozens of black MPs and councillors and mayors and so forth. So it becomes a sort of, you know, it's not what you think it is. But perceptions do start to become realities. And that, I think, is the issue. Alec, I don't know much about Action SA as a political vehicle. I do know a lot of it seems to be fueled on an anti-DA grievance. And once that's the kind of pull factor, you're going to get people joining you for a range of reasons. So I can't judge what the individual cases are. At the end of the day, the DA's got to do what the DA must do, and it's going to have put up with an enormous amount of background noise, which, you know, the volume gets cranked up the closer we get to an election. But I have to say, like King Solomon said, Alec, there's nothing new under the sun. You know, when I was the leader of the DP and then the DA, we put up with a lot of the same noise and comments. And what happened in my case was far worse than anything the DA has to contend with now, was what they called floor crossing. This sounds like ancient history, so let me not bore your listeners or viewers with that. But I mean, essentially, the ANC used what Mangosuthu Buthelezi called checkbook politics. They would actually line up MPs, get them to cross the floor and pay them, either by giving them positions, making a job in the Treasury available in one case, and they would line up five DA MPs who were black and get them into the ANC, and then they'd dump them at the first opportunity. But the visuals were terrible for the DA or the DP, as the case might be. And the problem here is that the perceptions then start to become baked into the party narrative. So I think if you look at any set of circumstances rather than some individuals coming and going, the DA remains a very diverse party. It's got, you know, public representatives far more diverse than any other party on the political stage, in parliament, in the councils. They've got proportionately more members of different racial groups than any other party. I mean, the fact that the ANC, their primary principal opponent, did not manage at their NEC out of, I think they elect 100 people odd, and that's a party popularity contest, a single Indian or coloured onto their NEC, and only one white person out of 100, tells you everything about the contempt that the ANC has for the concept of non-racialism, which it proclaims. Now, they had to co-opt one coloured, one whitey onto the NEC yesterday to compensate for this gross imbalance. Now, if the DA did that, if they elected sort of an all-white slate of leaders or MPs, I mean, the press would be over them like the proverbial rash. So that I think they carefully try and make their ranks more diverse. All the issue, once you start doing that, if you rely on new folks coming into the party or on traditionally part of it, there's always going to be some issue that people might not have the institutional loyalties that others who've been around longer, but the people who've been around the longest tend to come from the ranks of the usual suspects, i.e. white South Africans. So they try and diversify, but a lot of people without deep roots in the party might feel that they don't want to stay around for the long haul. As one of my predecessors said, the opposition job is the politics of the long haul, and that remains so.
Well, it brings us to the next really important part in South Africa's new democracy, which is the 2024 election. Pretty much everybody knows, or everybody is predicting, that the ANC will be below 50%. It just depends on how far below 50%. But if you look at this rainbow coalition as has been described by the guys in the Freedom Front, where the DA would be leading one with Action SA, IFP, Freedom Front, etc. Is it conceivable in your mind, given that you, where you started from in 1994 with what, a percent or so of of the vote, that this could be over 50%, the opposition could be over 50% in 2024, or is that maybe a bridge too far too soon?
Well, we simply don't know. I mean, I think a lot's in play at the moment, probably more, and I don't want to just, you know, you always get politicians, well, I'm an ex-politician, saying, Alec, the next election is the most important in our lifetime. Well, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's to get people to go and vote. This one is probably the most consequential. I wrote a book which came out last year or the year before called Future Tense, which basically looked at political liberation movements across the world, from Israel to India to Mexico. And basically, I said, after 30 years, this is just simply based on the statistics, liberation parties founding independence parties, from the Labour Party in Israel to Congress in India, tend to lose elections because 30 years is usually the limit. And we are at 30 years next year. So I think there's a distinct possibility the ANC will lose its grip on power. As you correctly said in your question, Alec, if they get in the low 40s, then significant coalitions become possible. If they get above 45%, they'll simply buy off the tiny rats and mice parties, as they've done elsewhere in municipalities, and they'll form a government which they'll be the overwhelming majority player in. And that's how it will pan out. So I think the first order of business before you can have a coalition is to actually make sure the ANC gets very low in the 40s or late 30s, and then coalitions become possible, and then you will have a game change. But, you know, there are a lot of caveats attached to that, Alec. I mean, we've seen recently in Joburg the debacle of trying to form multi-party stable opposition coalitions. Well, that's imploded twice, and many other, several other cities. So that's not a very positive or encouraging template. The second issue is, and here perhaps I part company with some of my friends in the DA, I think that there's a real danger if a coalition prospect looms that the ANC will form a coalition with the EFF, which will be an absolute unmitigated, unqualified disaster for the country and everyone who lives in it. And I don't have to elaborate to you or your viewers just how terrible that will be. And why I think that's possible is, in a sense, the ANC and the EFF are two tributaries in the same river. I mean, they come from each other. They're much closer to each other. I think what's disastrous for the country might not be disastrous for the ANC in terms of what it can swallow. Well, I think actually what will happen, the EFF will end up swallowing the ANC, but that's another matter which doesn't concern me. But I think you're going to see whether this is likely or not if the EFF and the ANC, two-nardering, continues in Joburg, Ekurhuleni, and in Tshwane, Pretoria. Because if they manage there to create three administrations and divvy up the spoils between them, that must be a significant flag for what's likely to come in South Africa next year if the ANC does badly. Now, you know, so I think if that happens, well, then the DA is out of the picture completely. And so all the other opposition-minded parties, genuine op, I mean, the Freedom Front you mentioned, even Action SA and others, the IFP, would not then be a factor. If for some reason the EFF and the ANC's mutual mistrust overwhelms any other short-term considerations, then I think it is possible that the DA could be part of a government. But that, you know, that's a possibility which has to be interrogated with caution, because simply sitting on top of an administration, i.e., you know, we're giving you five ministries, good luck, and you're sitting with a civil servant and with senior government officials who are completely antagonistic to what you're trying to achieve politically, is going to cost the party far more than they'll gain and the country from it. And I think you've seen to some extent that in Joburg, where a lot of hostility, not just between the coalition partners, but in the ranks of the administration, civil service, which is completely populated with ANC cadres. I mean, why should they have any interest in assisting a DA administration? And the DA is, I don't have the answer to that. I'm just posing the problem, which happily is what I can do now. It's not my job to provide the answers. If there is a prospect of a coalition, I hope that the people who are leading the DA discussions, think tank on it, will actually say, well, hang on, it's one thing to be the Minister of State Enterprises, should the DA get that, but what are we going to do with it? Who's we going to put in there? How are we going to make sure our writ runs vertically, right down from the top to the bottom of this administration? And that is that's a challenge of governance, not a challenge of politics.
It's quite a depressing picture that you've painted for us, Tony. So if you now were to wave a magic wand and say, let the DA get above 50% in the next election, and you're advising them from reputation management, from the realities, from the practicalities that we've discussed earlier of having to get the black vote or a bigger share of the black vote to be able to get to 50% of the national vote. 2024 might be too soon, but if you were able to advise, how would you change that perception, given that you've been both sides of the fence?
Well, look, a lot of it has to do with, I think you're talking about how does the DA perception change, so the DA gets more votes, or how do they...
How do you write a plan for Helen Ziller and John Steenhuisen, which is going to give them more than 50% of the vote next year? Do they both step aside and DA, get black leaders and that, et cetera?
No, that's all been tried. I mean, the DA did, you know, in an attempt, if you like, to short-circuit history, they thought, well, if we parachute an X, then X will bring a constituency with him or her, and it didn't happen. I think there are limitations. I think one must be absolutely realistic. I don't think the DA needs to get 50%. It needs to up its voter share. It's a bit like being a minority. It's a bit like being a minority shareholder in a company, but where your minority share can actually block the majority shareholder from doing what the majority shareholder wishes to do with the company. And I think that's, in a sense, the DA's role. It sounds a bit unexciting, but in a fragmenting polity, Alec, it actually becomes very valuable real estate. So if I was running the DA today, which I have no aspirations to do, if I was running the DA again today, I would say absolutely max out your potential votes where you can get them. You know, I had the benefit, and you obviously know this is a very smart guy, Ricardo Hausmann, when I was at Harvard. He lectured a course I was on. And Ricardo Hausmann said of the South African economy that the problem with the South African government is they trying to create an economy for the workers they wish they had rather than the workers they actually have. In other words, you know what that means. So I think the DA can't sort of get into that political contest where it dreams of an electorate it's not going to reach. The DA is not going to, for a range of reasons of history, get a whole lot of voters in the rural Eastern Cape or in Zululand or in, you know, I could give you a list of places it won't get. What it's got to do is to maximize the votes where it has the potential of access. So if I was running the DA, I would make sure that every, in any ward I'd want across South Africa, that every single potential voter there is registered. Because by maximizing what you've got and what you can potentially reach, you maximize your outcome on election day in the hope that the opposition, the ANC, is so dispirited and demoralized, they won't be able to maximize their vote. And obviously, they've got to keep the narrative positive. They've got a story to tell. I think it's a pretty good story about, you know, we you and I are speaking from the Western Cape, where we have less load shedding than the rest of the country, which is, you know, sounds like a race to the bottom, Alec. We have less load shedding because they took much better mitigation factors here than anyone else has tried. And they don't steal the money, and they, you know, they generally don't encourage criminality with the electricity connection. So there's just much better mitigation factors here than the rest of the country. And they need to project that and to broadcast that and say what's happened here, you can have everywhere. And look, to use that old aphorism, which is entirely true, all being reused again and again, oppositions don't win elections, governments lose elections. And this government, this is true in the recorded history of South Africa of the last, I don't know, decades, no government has done more to lose support than this government, the ANC government. It is a spectacular destruction of a country, its infrastructure, its job prospects, and the ANC can't run away from that. So, but the DA has got to, you know, offer some hope. It's got to maximize its turnout where it's got potential, not where it wished it had potential. And then I think they can, you know, put together a lot of runs on the score. They won't be at 50%, but they will make themselves a significant player if, and it's of course a big presupposition, the ANC is down in the 40s and the ANC is not disposed to form a coalition with the EFF. And there are a lot of ifs and buts there. But Alec, I don't see in the next 12 months any other road.
Fascinating insights, and thank you for reminding us about Ricardo Haussmann. I actually bumped into him. I was introduced to him, by the way, by the Minister of Trade in Davos. So, and
by our Minister of Trade.
Our Minister of Trade, yeah. So he's,
only our Minister of Trade would listen to what Ricardo says, then we'd be in a different place.
Well, Ibrahim Patel was listening carefully to what Ricardo was saying, and he spoke very highly of him. So who knows? Maybe there is a wind of change coming to our country. I love the fact that you've explained the template that exists in the Western Cape. The rest of the country can see it now. Obviously, when you travel to the Western Cape, you see the governance, you see the roads, you see just about everything of what a meritocracy for the whole country can bring us. And I guess in a way, we have to be very thankful that we have got that kind of politics in South Africa, where an opposition party at least had a chance to do things right in smaller pockets, like Christopher Pappas is doing it in the Mgeni municipality at the moment. Tony Leon, I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you for this conversation today. Before we go, your brother, Peter, he went into law, you went into politics. Was there any possibility that he would have followed you?
Well, he did for a while. We both went into law. I think, you know, we would, as someone said, a lawyer is a Jewish boy who can't stand the sight of blood when asked of it. So that's why he became a lawyer. I'm an attorney. Peter's an attorney. He stuck it out. I fled into politics from Edward Nathan. I didn't much like being, but I was passionate about politics. Peter put his toe into the political water in 1994. He got elected to the provincial legislature in Gauteng, 5 years, and he was actually the leader of the party. Not nepotism, he was elected by his colleagues. And I think that his partners at his law firm basically said, you've got a choice, you know, do you want to stick it out in politics, and you can't necessarily be a partner in our law firm doing both. So he had to make a choice, and he made the choice in 2000 or so and left politics. But I'd be, you know, because we come from both a legal and a political family, he remains, as I am, fascinated by politics. So whenever we're together, we talk a bit about law, we talk a lot about politics, even though he's always become a preeminent mining lawyer in the years.
Look forward to the next conversation. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.